Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Hannah Starr Rogers, visiting scholar at the University of Edinburgh in Science, Technology, and Innovation Studies. And we're talking about the book, Art, Science, and the Politics of Knowledge. Hannah, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Thanks so much for having me.
Now, this is a complicated book in some ways. It seeks to understand, and this is a quote from the book, the categories of art and science as labels with specific powers to order social worlds. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It sounds really complicated, but it's actually kind of like an easy idea. So there's an awful lot written about the philosophies of art and science, and a lot written where sociologists have gone in to talk with artists and scientists, but not too much that compares those two things. And since my background is in science and technology studies, I'm interested in the philosophy, the culture, and the history of science, usually, but in this case, of science and art together. To put this in even simpler terms, it's something that a lot of us are familiar with and probably lots and lots of your listeners are. The puzzle really began for me with the Harvard glass blowers. And I was at Cornell, and so I was looking at the glass marine animals who are kind of the cousins of those glass blowers that come later. And I was amazed by the fact that the collection is kept both in a biological context and in an art context, but they're the same things, right? It's the same models. We might easily have switched them around. So how does it come to be that in some times and places, an object clearly seems to have scientific value, we understand it as science, and other times it seems to have art value, and we understand it as art?
Does it depend upon the audience that's looking at it?
Maybe it does. Surely in some cases it does. And in some cases you get into these arguments where both groups are saying, hey, wait, that actually belongs to us. We have jurisdiction to tell you what that means and why we should value it. And so I'm interested in how it is that both the practitioners who are saying, me, 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 that belongs to our group, and the people who are actually making this stuff, who might be making claims like, hey, actually, it's science, it's not art, I don't want to be part of your team. Why are they doing that? And what's at stake for them doing it? So the book argues, and I'll make it really quick, right? You kind of, this book is available online. You can read lots of the details. But the concept is that there are rhetorical strategies and there are material strategies that both artists and scientists use to say, my bit belongs in this group or my bit doesn't belong in that group.
And what are the relationships between those two groups? And do they overlap?
Yes, that is what I think is the most exciting part. So Michael Sayre has made a wonderful argument about how the future is going to be about these interdisciplinary kinds of works. And I totally agree with that, that the grand challenges of our time are already both art, science, sociology, history. There are all kinds of projects kind of together are going to be needed to answer problems like climate change or the COVID crisis. But that isn't just something that's about the future. It's also about the past that, for example, these glass marine animals, but there are many other examples of different kinds of things that artists and scientists have made that they actively positioned as being art or science. And they had some specific reasons for doing that. And trying to understand these things as categories, I think will make it a lot easier to think about hybrid knowledge.
Now, it's interesting. There's a lot of, I know a lot of artists, and I've interviewed them on the show, who use science as the basis for their work. But, and as you mentioned in your book, rarely has art been seen as a direct contributor to the scientific enterprise. So very rarely, and I can't think of a good example myself, where science has said, yeah, the contribution from art has really helped us out.
That's an interesting part of the power dynamic of our age in relation to these problems. So the dominance of, say, artists' guilds, pre-Enlightenment, where those people who were parts of artist guilds were really making the thing that we now refer to as science before that word even exists, are kind of a separate matter from what I've actually covered in this book. But it's really important to remember that that power dynamic of like who gets to count and who's part of it is a thing that's constructed and hasn't really been consistent
right
over time.
I wanted to ask you, though, the one thing that I didn't get out of this is mathematics. Where is mathematics in all of this? Because I've interviewed quite a few pure mathematicians, and I can tell you, compared to the scientists that I've interviewed, they're in a different time-space continuum. And it's like, and yet they will talk about the aesthetics of equations. There's an entire book called "It Must Be Beautiful," which is all about the history of certain equations And the way they're judged, at least to them, is to talk about aesthetics. And I always thought that was fascinating. But I'll tell you, pure mathematicians are very difficult people to deal with.
Maybe there are some theoretical artists who we'd find to be the same sort and being kind of complicated interlocutors. I think what you're saying is absolutely right, that there are sets of values inside science and art that seem to overlap. I think that's why we've seen lots of discussion about, for example, overlaps in creativity or approaches to materials that have kind of made it possible for artists and scientists to talk to each other, because instead of talking with their philosophy, they talk with, like, how does this thing work? And then they can kind of get down in it in the questions together. So I would say to this point about mathematics that there certainly have been a huge number of collaborations between poets and dancers and mathematicians. And also it seems lots of theoretical physicists are interested in that. And maybe they're more able to speak each other's language because they have some overlapping terms like aesthetics. On the other hand, what they actually mean by aesthetics, when we dig down to that, might be a bit more complicated. So I would say that some of those value systems might have some sense that they overlap, and then that gives them something to talk about, but it might not mean precisely the same thing.
There's a new body of photography that just came out, and I'm just blanking on the artist's name, but it was compiled in a book, and it was called Do Not Erase, where all she did is came in and photographed the chalkboards of mathematicians and physicists. And her photographs have become of that work have become artworks in and of themselves.
I'm not familiar with that book, but I love that kind of idea that we can kind of reframe a material so it works for us as an artwork or as a science work. To something that you were saying before, part of this is the attention the audience has for it, right?
Yeah.
The kind of thing we pay attention to when we're told you're about to encounter science or you're about to encounter art. At the moment, I'm working at the Medical Museum in Copenhagen, and when people approach what's going to be in our exhibitions, they're frequently cued to thinking, I'm about to encounter scientific information. And this gives us all kind of amazing opportunities to bring artists in and kind of complicate what things people are expecting to see, what they actually see, the degree of interaction. So in some ways, those rhetorics that are put out by people who are doing science communication, which includes people like me working in museums, may actually serve to reify or cause people to have even more stereotypes about what art and science are, not because that's what they are in the lab, not because that's what they are in published papers, but because of the way we treat that information and present it to the public.
What's STS?
Great. So my PhD is in science and technology studies, and this is a reasonably new discipline that says, let's take things from the humanities and use them to study what's going on in science. And so they've had a lot of success thinking about different cultures that approach medicine in different ways, for example, but also questions about how subjects and knowledge are found to be constructed in relation to the kind of people who are working together to produce that knowledge, the kinds of resources they have access to. So some of the methods they'd use are things like going out and watching scientists do what they do in a laboratory or interviewing a group of mathematicians. So they're using sociology and history methods to try to understand what's happening often in contemporary science.
Now, you see art and science as indistinguishable at times, and you sort of strive to that we should be trying to treat art and science symmetrically, and expand on that. Do you feel like we're giving short shrift to art?
I do. I think that there is a power dynamic that's going on that is just a historical artifact in which we're really privileging science. And there are great reasons for that because of the way that we have structured our notions about research and innovation, basically since World War II, that have made us feel that that's a driver of the economy. And in other places, I might add, you know, Denmark, many places in Europe, there have been different ideas about what it was that drove the economy or whether that was something that knowledge ought to be doing for us anyhow. And so, yes, I think it's absolutely true that there is a power dynamic issue. We see this when we bring an artist and scientist together to do a collaboration, that there's some, you know, treading on both sides about where is our territory, but also just some issues about who has had access to lots of resources through their careers. At the same time, I don't want to say these two things are indistinguishable. I think that depends on the lens. So it's possible to say that the glass marine animals have really fit really well into art and science at different times. But actually, I don't think that works as well if you say did it look like art at the same time it looked like science? In that particular case, that's kind of less true. And so maybe that tells us something about the way that science and art themselves can change. We can have different ideas, not only just kind of advances or changes in focus, but really changes in the values of how we say this knowledge counts for us, or this is a central piece of knowledge, in this body of thought in science, or this body of thought in the arts.
Let's talk about the glass flowers. I grew up with the glass flowers. I grew up in Watertown, Massachusetts, and I was one of those kids that used to go to the Museum of Zoology on their own on weekends, just hang out there. And I have been hanging out with the glass flowers since I was a kid a long time ago, and they're at the Harvard Museum of Natural History. But the sea creatures are something I didn't know where they were. Talk to me about where the sea creatures are.
Sure. So we really think of the pinnacle of Leopold and Rudolf Blaschka's work as being in the glass flowers. And indeed, the majority of their working years are producing these thousands of amazing flowers and diseases on flowers and vegetables and diseases on vegetables and root clusters. And
just
an amazing array of stuff. But before they were doing that, they have a little bit of a time figuring out what they're going to do with their ability in realism.
Now they started out creating eyes for taxidermy.
Exactly.
I never knew that. But it's a logical leap then to create models for science.
I think that's exactly right. That the they're already hooked up with a network that's valuing their work. So it's easy to kind of imagine moving over. But even before the eyes for taxidermy, they actually created a set of orchids, which they were basically going into royal homes around Germany. And so these were like purely decorative. They were realist. Unfortunately, they were destroyed in a fire. Yeah. But they're really decorative objects, and they're describing themselves in their early catalogs as really being artists, like Hiram Artisanal Skills. And later, once they have access to that market through the taxidermy eyes, you see a real shift, and they start to talk about like the bloodlines of the artists and that make it possible, the observational power that they think is really important in order to position themselves to be able to contribute to science. They have to describe themselves as artists in kind of the right way.
Now, it's Leopold and Rudolf Blaschka, father-son.
Yes.
And how did they describe themselves? I think in your book you mentioned they described themselves as natural history artisans. And like I mentioned, a lot of people are familiar with the glass flowers at the Harvard Museum of Zoology. But there's another whole collection of sea creatures, which I've never seen. And I loved reading about them in your book. And those were at Cornell?
That's right. They're actually scattered all over the globe.
And they were actually discovered. Yeah. They had been put away for a while, and then somebody actually brought them out of a cabinet.
That's right. Tom Eisner, who is now really famous for his chemical signaling in bugs. So he's looking at insects and understanding the way that pheromones are working and that they're communicating through chemical signals. When he first begins, a professor at Cornell, he actually finds these in a locked, kind of messed up case outside his office. And he gets one of his graduate students to get out there and try to see if they can get into the case. Because he recognizes them. He realizes that they're kind of something special, and then finds out, indeed, they are connected with the Blaschka glass flowers. But there are thousands of these models worldwide. I mean, there is a beautiful collection at Cornell, but there are many, many collections really literally all over the world.
Do we know much about how they created them? What was the process? And did they study preserved examples, or did they work from illustrations?
They did. So the son, Rudolf, goes on a number of collecting trips with people from Harvard, and he's both drawing specimens in the field and seeing specimens in the field. They kept an aquarium in their home when they were working on the glass marine animals. And, that's really solving – these glass marine animals are really solving a problem that people have, which is when you put this thing in a jar, it doesn't look so good. It doesn't look really like what it looked like in the Mediterranean. So keeping that aquarium is an important part of being able to make the right kind of observation. In addition, it duplicated something that scientists of their day who they're writing letters with are doing. They're keeping these home aquariums. And so there's both a layer of the direct observation, the thing they might need, but also the rhetoric of, hey, I've got one too, right? Have the materials you're working with. I can go to the source and create the kind of model you need.
Now, how are these used?
Mainly in pedagogical settings where it wasn't possible to have the color preserved or the shape really preserved.
Well, that's what happens with preserved specimens. Yeah. The color fades like within a day or sooner. So here you have these specimens where the color will never fade.
Yeah, they're really in some ways more ideal than the thing itself. Right?
Never say that. Never say that. No, honey. No, Hannah. Right? They're not better than nature. Don't go there.
They answer a problem we have better than the other preservation technique we have. And, you know, photographs, of course, they're easier to circulate, and they're often what students are using yep. now. But we could also put students into the field in a different way than we could in the 1800s. So these were being set out on lab tables and studied as if they had been the thing itself in the Cornell context.
And they're also larger than reality, too, in the case of the flowers sometimes. You actually see...
Yeah. This is really important with the glass marine animals because some are indeed smaller. Many, many are life size, and some are blowing up particular features or emphasizing features in the same way we might shoot a photograph that really let you see the polyps.
Yeah.
You know, like here the polyps are oversized. Sometimes they get it more right than was known at the time. They'll have, you know, the right number of little legs on something that doesn't seem to have been recorded. Yet it's really a remarkable degree of observation and execution that is in these models.
Now, how were these models treated at the time? Were they treated as art for science, or just scientific models?
Well, it's certainly true that the Velasquez are describing themselves as, you know, artisans. That word is still present for them.
But was that just practical for them to get more work? In other words, That's the term that they needed to use to get more jobs.
That's what I think. That's what I argue in the book, is that we shouldn't think about this as like some super deep identity, but rather we should think about the pragmatics of it.
Okay.
You know, what did this identity mean in terms of the kinds of contracts they might be able to secure? So they go into a lot of description of like our bloodline, right? We've kind of come down through this long lineage of glass artisans and observers. That's why we're able to do this. And indeed, they don't tell us that much about how they do their work. In fact, they tend to just tell us what they didn't do. We didn't squeeze these automatically into forms.
Right? Yeah.
Information about, you know, how we did it, rather like the ways we didn't do it. We're more interested in correcting that. But this kind of notion of the artisan as a kind of technical worker seems to be what they're putting forward, as opposed to the artisan as an aesthetic worker, which is fascinating because they're so beautiful, right? It's really hard to turn away, especially for those of us who love something photoreal. You know, when you photograph one of these models, it looks as if you've taken a picture of the thing itself.
My guest tonight is Hannah Starr Rogers, visiting scholar at the University of Edinburgh in Science, Technology, and Innovation Studies. And we've been talking about her book, Art, Science, and the Politics of Knowledge. This is WICN and Uncle Mark. It's pretty obvious. Okay, in the case of glass flowers, we're talking about perfect objects that sort of inhabit that overlapping world of art and science. Where things get really weird, and I love this chapter in your book, is about bioartists. And that's where things get deeply strange. We're talking about Symbiotica and Oren Katz. Let's talk about this. What is bioart?
Great question. So bioart now is a movement that's almost 25 years old, and these are artworks that are made out of biological materials, usually associated with biotechnology. So they're artworks that literally use, you know, microscopes and protocols that come out of tissue culture and living things that are set up in experimental designs that we would be familiar with in a biology or environmental science department. And it isn't just that they're using those materials to make some sort of aesthetic comment. They're using them to critique what's going on in science.
And that's the difference between the glass flowers we were talking about. So these are artworks as critiques of the thing that they're working with.
Yes.
So they're biting the hand that feeds them.
That's one way to think of it.
It's in typical artist's fashion.
that we couldn't really reach these types of critiques without using the materials that scientists use. And at least in the case of Symbiotica, it seems pretty clear that the department, they're actually located in a science department.
Yeah. And they share lab space. They share lab space.
Yeah, it seems the scientists really see some value in having people bring other kinds of ideas and philosophies into what they're doing. The critique that I'm talking about might seem clear from somebody who is thinking in a public science communication way. Mm. The scientists seem much more open to this, right? Like, yeah, let's think about that in a different way. Like, what are the ways that we should think about the ethics of cells, lines that we culture and then dispose of? How should we think about what it means that there's a lot of discussion about a genetic modification
yep.
that's really
yep.
being done purely for a scientific reason, and the public's never going to have contact with it. So there are these kind of alien species that we're making and disposing of really regularly in laboratories.
It seems like this particular science, genetic manipulation especially, is one of the ones where, first of all, sharing lab space can make sense and it's doable. When I think about theoretical physics or cosmology, sharing lab space with artists doesn't seem as natural or as good a fit. Mm. And have you found that? Is that some sciences lend themselves to a collaboration with artists more than other sciences?
Well, it's very hard to say kind of like what are the numbers. I'm not aware of like a systematic review of who was involved with which ones. But
yep,
I would say
yep.
that there is some kind of affinity where people in physics and mathematics have tended to work particularly with dancers or
That's
performance
fascinating.
Artists.
I find that interesting.
I do too. I would love to really do a systematic study that said who are the people collaborating in this way, where we see tons of installation artists who are working with scientific materials, and I think that might be because they need to build a relatively stable lab setup in a gallery in order to show their work at all, especially if, say, they're growing something with plants or bacteria over time. It's requiring something different than a performance art piece, and so there seem to be these, you know, interesting affinity groups that build up.
Let's talk about some of the artwork specifically. Talk to me about the Pig Wings Project.
Oh, the Pig Wings Project is a project that's meant in great irony that kind of when pigs fly. So the idea is let's tissue culture pig wings, and then let's talk about it as if it's going to be this gigantic thing, as if they're really going to be living pigs with wings on their backs that can fly. But in fact, what we actually see in the gallery are these really tiny wings and a little petri dish, and they're coupled to our kinds of wings, one that is if it were a dinosaur wing, like what kind of wings would the pig even have, right? Like what kind of other tissue culture would we add together to get a pig wings? And I think this is playing off of Visconti's mouse that we're probably, many of us are familiar with the mouse that had
yep.
the ear
yep.
on its back that people thought was something genetically modified, but was in fact tissue culture. So I think the artists are saying here, hey, there's a ton of potential here, but you guys are really selling it hard, right? There are a lot of limitations. You're not really near a place where pigs are going to fly. You're making a lot of promises, but it's largely hype. Really what you've got is some tiny wings that don't function that are inside this petri dish. And so on one hand, the scientists might say back, hey, no, wait, like that's not what we're trying to do. And on the other hand, I think it really makes the public aware of what some of those limitations are, what some of the hype is. And, you know, it's a lot more to the point when you see these material pig's wings that can ever be if we're just describing to you that, hey, remember, there are limitations.
There are some things that come out of these genetic experiments by the scientists, not the artists, that really do seem like they're just scurrying around, like when they're creating luminous mice or something like that. I think like, why are we doing that? What is doing that? And that's where the Pig's Wing Project seems like a reasonable, like a fascinating political art project, because it's criticizing that aspect of it. Yes, we can do it, but should we be doing it? Seems to be a big question that seems to be investigating. Let's talk about victimless crimes.
Oh, maybe victimless leather. So victimless leather is a
yeah.
project that's made out of rat skin cells, and they are seeded into a tiny polymer that's shaped like a jacket. So then you have this, you know, rat skin jacket that's alive, right? And this goes along with some of the notions about victimless leather that have been circulating,
wow.
that we're going to be able to culture meat or leather.
Yep.
So we won't have to use whole animals anymore. We'll just use the cell lines. And again, these artists are not saying, you know, one way or the other about the ethics of that part. They're saying that there are important technical limitations that haven't been overcome here. And so when we say there's no victim because there's no whole animal dying, that's really not the case. Plus, both we have these living cells that kind of are dying in this process, but also that bovine fetal serum is needed to keep these kind of cultures alive. And that means there needs to be a continual flow of fetal calves used in order to produce that serum. So we're pretty far from really saying it's victimless.
Now, we're going to run out of time, and I could talk about that chapter for hours. You also have some really interesting thoughts about the curation of these works. Like the curation of living works of art presents real problems to museums.
It does. I'd like to argue that we have wonderful science centers and wonderful art centers and not that many great places that are able to handle both. And that's
so you're envisioning an art science center that specifically deals with art projects like this.
Of course, that would be wonderful. But even just getting the centers that we have to figure out how to show things on both ends, I think would give people a more realistic sense of how knowledge works, that most things are hybrid. Most things don't fit into one category or the other. And we really need that because we're turning around to a bunch of different major challenges that are going to require interdisciplinary thinking. We want our kids and the public thinking in these interdisciplinary ways. So we need to present them information in an interdisciplinary way.
You know, I mentioned the name Orrin Katz. Can you just tell me who it is for the benefit of the audience?
Oh, sure. So Orrin Katz is a trained designer who founded Symbiotica, which is at the University of Western Australia, and has won a number of major prizes for his work. He, along with his wife, Yonette Zur, work as tissue culture and art. And if you plug that into a Google search, you can get some amazing images.
He's an interesting guy. He seemed to get more conservative as the years went by, as far as looking at the relationship between art and science.
That's an interesting point. I think Orrin's been through a lot of different stages. I had first worked with him a decade ago.
Wow.
As a graduate student going down to the laboratory at Symbiotica. And he's certainly been through a lot of different iterations, to my mind, of what the relationship between art and science is. And he is very interested in continuing to hold up some difference and saying that we don't just want to slosh things around. There are important things that art is, that science isn't, and vice versa.
Well, he has a quote in your book, when artists do science, it is often bad science. And when scientists do art, it is often bad art. And in some cases, that's really true.
I think it is.
I can't believe
it. But I think it's different to say, like, these knowledge communities are identical and we should just throw them together. It doesn't matter if you're an artist or a scientist, or to say the ideas of science and art are constructed. We need to think about the way they fit together and the way we argue that something counts as one or the other. What's the power that's at stake? And I don't think that's something Orrin would object to.
My guest tonight has been Hannah Starr Rogers, visiting scholar at the University of Edinburgh in Science, Technology, and Innovation Studies. And we just barely scratched the surface of her book, Art, Science, and the Politics of Knowledge. Hannah, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you again.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mike Lynch. Good night.